Today is September the 13th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and in the studio with me is my colleague, Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and the program is live streamed on the Internet at WBAI.org at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Podcasts of the program is available at PRN.FM and WBAI.org and our website, PCRadioshow.org. When WBAI is in membership drive, a replacement program may be scheduled, but the regular program will always continue to be available each week at PRN.FM. Last week, however, we had some technical difficulties with a regular program on WBAI, and the regularly scheduled program is available as on podcast at PRN.FM and our website, PC Radio Show, that's all one word, PCRadioshow.org. And if you get a chance and if you haven't heard it, listen to it because it's going to be very interesting. And last week, it's sad to note that Jerry Pennell passed away September the 8th at age 84. He was an American science fiction writer, and I've read many of his articles. He was a regular contributor to Byte magazine. It was one of the first computer magazine that was published in the 1970s.
You know, his column, Chaos Manor, was a very technical column, and it was, for a lot of people, it was unreadable. When I started reading it, Hank, I knew nothing about computers, and I learned a great deal from him. He's also a very, very good science fiction writer, often with his co-author,
You just had a senior citizen moment. Go ahead, Joe.
At any rate, Jerry Pernell and Byte Magazine will be missed.
And by the way, as a follow-up to last week's news item, I was very careful to say it in a way so that we wouldn't be involved in a lawsuit. At least, I was concerned with that. And what happened was that, when I started working in the 1960s, and one of the things that I worked with was ARPANET, and to me, Raymond, or otherwise known as Ray Tomlinson, he implemented the first email program on ARPANET. And that was a precursor to the Internet. And this was done in 1971.
Hank, for those who fouled up with the alphabet soup, ARPA stood for Advanced Research Project Agency, and it was part of the Defense Department.
Yeah, and this was the first system to send mail between different users on different hosts connected, what they call the ARPANET. And what happened was that Shiva Ayyadurai, I hope I pronounced it correctly, when he was 14 years old, he wrote a functional program that he called email, and he has he called it email, and he's been filing lawsuits against people who challenge his claim that said he said he invented email in 1978, and
he had a point, Hank. When he was 14. He invented a thing called email. Tomlinson invented a thing where you can send messages between different host computers, but he didn't call it email.
Well, the clarification here is that the reason why he said he invented email was because the Copyright Office accepted his registration. And as far as I knew, okay, was that copyright is for something that you've done, but not as an invention. Invention, you have to patent it to be an invention. And that was my understanding of it. But I didn't want to get into an argument about it. And so I just basically repeated what he said. And what happened last week was a Massachusetts judge finally came up with a decision. And he said that he dismissed the libel lawsuit and ruled that the coverage on it, that the First Amendment as protected speech did not run afoul of any libel laws. And I'll read exactly what he said, okay? The articles at issue do not dispute that plaintiff created an email system. In other words, he didn't rule on whether he did or did not. Rather, they dispute whether plaintiff should properly be characterized as the inventor of email based on that creation. Accordingly, it is not clear that the allegation in the complaint are sufficient to show that the statement at issue are false. However, in any event, even assuming that the allegations of falsity are sufficient, the challenge statements are nonetheless protected under the First Amendment.
The First Amendment is an interesting amendment to our Constitution, which says very specifically who it's referring to. It says the government shall make no law respecting the freedom of the press. Now, does that mean that nobody can? No, absolutely not. I can say to Hank, anything that you say on this show cannot say anything about politics. And he can't sue me for the First Amendment. I'm not the government. He can kick me in the nose if he wants to, but he can't.
Well, I've been fascinated that in the last year or two, with all the politics been going on, I was wondering, why do people keep saying, in my opinion? And when you say, in my opinion, it's sort of like it takes it off the...
That's the curse. It's like saying alleged.
Okay. Because in my opinion, you look ugly. Well, that's my opinion. You can't challenge that, you're saying.
That's correct. And I can, in turn, I can say, it's been alleged that you're an idiot.
Well, for... just to put this in proper perspective, okay, is that he did write a program in Fortran. He submitted to the Copyright Office. His interpretation, along with his lawyer, interpreted that as acceptance by the government as an invention.
And the Copyright Office doesn't really go beyond the minimum law. You have to submit two copies, you have to fill out a form, and then you get a copyright.
You can write a novel and copyright it. I mean, you know, that's what people do.
But you can also plagiarize it and copyright the plagiarized copy.
However, if it exceeds a certain percentage, then you could be sued.
Yes, but until you're sued, you have a copyright on it.
But he said because it was accepted by the government accepted as an invention, and there's nothing that the government has issued saying is an invention. Just said that they received it and they accepted it.
What is a copyright? It's a claim of ownership. That's all it is.
Yeah, it's a claim. By the way, the other thing that we covered last week, which is extremely interesting, is that the General Services Administration, along with the FBI, had ordered removal of all... Actually, the FBI said that the government should not be using any Kaspersky software, period.
Right, but that was their recommendation.
Right, their recommendation, and the GSA then put out an order to remove all Kaspersky software platforms from, you know, from...
Now, what was the reasoning behind that? Who's Kaspersky? Why should they take it out on Kaspersky?
Well, now, in all fairness to Kaspersky, because I've used this stuff is good. They're not saying that Kaspersky did anything wrong. They're not saying Kaspersky is an agent of Russia. They're not saying that at all.
They're doing it by association. They're implying.
They're implying, but they cannot prove that they're a government agent.
Now, there's an interesting thing there because everybody's in favor of, you know, information should be free, knowledge should be spread, and everybody's in favor of that. But then the question becomes, do you really want your governmental business, forget private business for the moment, do you really want your governmental business to be dependent upon a foreign hostile power? And the question is really an obvious one. No, you don't. You don't want your infrastructure. You don't want anything in the hands of a foreign power that is not friendly. Now, I buy that, but how many iPhones do we have?
I was just going to say that if you want to do that, let's be consistent and not just pick on one nation, because our biggest commerce is not with Russia but with China.
And let me tell you something, Hank. If I had the power to say no more iPhones, the entire country would come down on me with both feet and crush me under the weight.
Well, maybe you gave me a solution how to get back at you.
Give me the
power. No, seriously.
I happen to agree with the fact that we should be very careful of using Kaspersky Kaspersky is in bed with the Kremlin, and it's...
No. You're saying in bed, there's no proof of that, okay? There's no hard proof of that.
Oh, let me give you the proof, the same proof the FBI has. Its headquarters are in Moscow. Everything that is in Moscow is under control of the
Kremlin. Foxconn is located in mainland China, okay?
I'm going to get to that. So I happen to...
And you know that the Chinese military really runs the industries there.
All the industries.
Correct.
So we are buying our cell phones, which I don't think our government could run without iPhones right now.
Yeah, but we have a, you know.
You know that there is a back door in every iPhone, Hank, that allows the people in Beijing to listen to every phone call made in this country.
Now,
wait a minute. They listen to every single phone call, and they make notes on it. So everything you say that's heard on an iPhone is going right to Beijing.
Well, I think the bigger issue...
Wait a minute. We've got to make sure the audience understands that was just tongue-in-cheek, and I
correct,
didn't mean it.
Right. But I think that the bigger issue is that Kaspersky products, the coding of it has been incorporated in the Microsoft operating system, of which they can change. But what about the routers that that they have coding in? Now, what do you do with that? Are you going to throw away your router?
It comes differently. When the code was the Kaspersky written code was taken and put into the firmware of the routers, somebody like you looked at that code and decided which pieces should go into the firmware. Anything that even looked like a backdoor, you would have examined and said, well, what's the purpose of this piece of code? So I'm not concerned with the pieces of code that had been vetted and then used elsewhere. But what they're saying is since Kaspersky has not given the source code for his various products, antivirus products.
No. Don't say they haven't given any code because we don't know that because...
No, but we do know the following. They have offered to. They
yes.
have actually offered
yes,
the FBI
that
the source code. And the FBI said, no, we don't want it. And the FBI sort of said what a great many politicians in this country have said over the years. I've already made up my mind. Please don't confuse me with the facts.
Well, let me give you a different scenario, Joe. Let's say it's open source software, and I find that there's a vulnerability. And do you feel I should tell the world after I found a fix for it, that there is a vulnerability, or should I just keep my mouth shut that there's a vulnerability with a fix? What do you say?
I say that you should. You're saying open source software,
and I'm working on it, and I find that there is a vulnerability, but I don't tell you about it until I also say yes, there's a vulnerability, but here's a fix for it.
Once you publish the fix for it. And it make it commonly available. You
mm-hmm.
don't make it a private thing in your pocket. Then I think you have an obligation to tell the world about
it. Okay. Now, what happened was Apache Software Foundation worked on open source software called Struts, okay, S-T-R-U-T-S. And what happened was that they found a vulnerability, and they felt that they it had to be fixed, which they fixed. It was a backdoor. And once they fixed it, they said, we have to tell the world about the vulnerability, and here's the fix for it. And if a company doesn't apply the fix, what do you do?
Well, legally, there is nothing you can do.
And guess what? That's what happened in March of this year with Equifax.
And as a result, 143 million approximately.
At least. And by the way, they say 143 million in the United States because UK, Australia, and there were other countries affected. They only told you 143 million in the United States.
That doesn't matter.
Okay, I'm in the United States. That's all I care about, right?
My name is on that list. I don't know if yours is. It's funny because as soon as the source came out for how you could find out, I put my name down and I put my wife's name down. I was told that, unfortunately, I probably was affected. My wife came back the message, unfortunately, you're not affected.
Well, one of the things that I need clarification, I didn't get a chance to do, is that when I originally heard about it, they said, okay, you can go find out. And they had what is a arbitration clause, okay? And they've since announced that they removed it. I haven't verified it. Joe, you said you.
I have verified.
You have verified, okay? Now here's my question: amongst the information,
incidentally, the arbitration clause that they included
had nothing to do with the vulnerability at all. Has to do with the service.
The service to give you some protection against that vulnerability.
But why did they mix the two together?
No, because they each existed, and what they did was they cut and pasted. And this was something that I can't tell you how stupid that was.
Well, I think that one of the things that I raise, and you have a solution for it, but I don't think it's a good solution, but it's the only solution to it, is that your Social Security number, unless you apply for a new one, which most people, it's yours. The year you were born, you can't change that, right? And now, if that is already out in the wild, what protection do you have?
Well, there's more complications than that. When they originally published this, that they had been hacked and extremely sensitive personal information from at least 143 million people had been taken by hackers and put out into the wild, what they did was they offered that they would provide you with their premium identity theft software, their anti this and their anti that. Well, their original contract said that any problems that they might have with that software or that program would be resolved by arbitration. They also threw in there that, well, we are giving it to you absolutely free for 1 year. It will automatically renew after that.
And it'll cost you.
Automatically
cost you. And
how would they charge you? Well, in order to get the free, you had to provide them with a credit card.
Correct, which is like, wait a minute. You mean to say you're going to profit from this screw-up?
No, it got worse than that, Hank, because the first thing that people like me said was, you couldn't keep my name and address confidential, and you want me to give you a credit card? I mean, come on, and how stupid do I have to be?
And you know what the other criticism was is that the site you go to is a different domain name.
Well, it was a different domain name, but it wasn't really a different domain. That was registered very simply that way. And it was registered that way because there was so much unrelated material on the Equifax.com site that they were hoping to simplify it for people. That one part was legitimate. All the other things were just stupid. They weren't just not legitimate. They were stupid. So now, after being yelled at by so many people, and incidentally, as a side, Hank will explain to you why several people want the CIO and the CFO and the CEO.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up because
let's finish the first thing before we jump to that. But they all sold some stock at a great profit. The problem was that so many stupid things were done.
Well, hang on. When you say great profit, let's say the stock dropped when it was announced, because this is related, okay? They knew about this July 29th, and they only made the public announcement on it September 8th. What happened? 6 weeks go by before they even tell the public?
Well, they had to figure out what they were going to do, and what they were going to do is sell a lot of stock.
And what happened was that this was not stock sold before. This was stock sold after they found out, 3-4 days after, and you say, well, maybe. But a CFO? You can't tell me a CFO didn't know what was going on.
Well, first of all, that poor CFO.
What do you mean poor CFO?
That poor CFO who was trying to make $1 million profit on this deal had to first exercise his options before he could sell them. That takes time.
As soon as it was announced, the stock dropped 20%, okay?
Oh, that was after he sold his stock.
That was after he sold his stock. But he sold his stock after they found out that they had this vulnerability.
Well, did you expect him to take a loss just to make you feel better?
By the way, isn't that considered against the law what he did?
Insider trading? I don't know.
Now, wait a minute.
Martha Stewart.
I was going to say Martha Stewart got went to jail just for lying to the FBI.
She listened to somebody who had had insider information. She didn't. Let's get back to the original.
No, seriously.
There were so many complaints about the way they handled it that they sat down and two guys sat down. One said, "Hank, how should we really have done this?" And Hank said, "Well, you should publish this, 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 and this." And that's what they've now done.
Now, wait a minute. But they had 6 weeks elapsed time, and I'm sure that they had legal people review each action, and they screwed up on each of the actions, okay?
Yes.
They did.
And if I was the CEO of that company, I would look for new lawyers.
Now, Congress is saying there should be investigations. Someone should go to jail.
It'll never happen.
Well, because...
Congress is basically...
No, wait a minute. Because negligence and stupidity, you can't go to jail on. You got to prove a criminal charge.
That's right.
Negligence
you can go to jail on, but not stupidity. And this was all stupidity.
Okay, let me ask you, not applying the patch, is that stupidity or negligence?
That's stupidity.
Not negligence?
No.
Okay. Selling the stock after it happened, was that stupidity or negligence?
That was pure stupidity.
That was pretty stupid, right?
You knew, you're going to look in the mirror and say, how could you be so stupid?
Now, one of the things that I do want to cover before we go to our next topic.
Incidentally, before we go on, Hank, I'd like to again tell the audience to do a pro bono explanation. Neither Hank nor I are lawyers. All of what we just said was pure personal opinion.
And everything we say is in our opinion.
It's in our opinion. And actually, to go a little bit further, we alleged that these people were stupid.
Yeah. By the way, the one of the things that we didn't cover early in the year, but it did happen, is that, and now it all ties in. This happened in the first 2 weeks in January of this year.
What, the Equifax thing?
Yeah. No. Well, let me tell you what it is. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is a government agency, okay, announced that two of the three major credit reporting agencies, which happens to be Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian, okay, what they said was that they found that two of the three, Equifax and TransUnion, have been deceiving and taking advantage of Americans, and they were fined $23 million, okay? And what happened was that they found that these two agencies were misrepresenting the scores they provided to the consumers, and they were different from what they provided to lenders and business institutions.
Now, this was the Consumer...
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau of the United States.
Which a significant number of politicians are trying to get rid of. And they particularly hate the woman who founded it.
Well, I just want to tell you that...
That's Elizabeth Warren.
Okay. I just want to tell you that these two agencies is that... you could get a great credit score, but that doesn't mean that that's what's being reported when your credit is being checked by TransUnion and Equifax. But by the way, in all fairness, the third one, Experian, was honest.
As far as we know.
Well, what the union is, By the way, you know what someone said to me? Well, I can find out whether or not I've been affected or not by this thing with Equifax by checking with Experian. No, because it's Equifax that they committed the problem. Experian and TransUnion have no idea whether it was open or not.
Well, Hank, maybe I better clear something up. Folks, write this down. It says Equifax... Security 2017 as one word, Equifax Security 2017, the numbers as one word, add .com to it, and your browser will take you to the page at Equifax where you can enter your last name, the last six digits of your Social Security, and they will tell you whether or not you were affected by this breach.
Okay. Now, what happened also, I just want to get into it because I want to cover it because this was news that happened yesterday. And actually, it's more than just yesterday. It's been going on for a full month. And when I say full month, I'm talking about all the Apple iPhone leaks that's been going to the press.
Oh, I know everything about it. Just ask me. I've read every leak there was.
Yeah. Well, And then I saw a one of these journal headlines. You know, they said, "We were right. The Apple iPhone is way under $1,000."
It was by, I think, 100 cents.
No, no, no. What happened was, if you read very carefully, okay, the Apple's announcement was on two phones, the iPhone 10 with an X and the 8.
Two different 8s.
Yeah, and they were referring to the 8 as being well under $1,000, and he claimed, "You see, I got it right. It was well under." And then in the, you know, but they spent the first two, three paragraphs talking about the 10, and you were on your, "Wait a minute. It's a dollar difference." And yet, he's saying, "Well, see, I was right. I really meant the other one."
Explain to the folks why it was called 10, because they're up to the 8 now.
Well, very simple, is because they used OS X. I remember one of the listeners said, "You know, you call it OS 10, and it's called OS X." And I said to myself, "Well, I'm not going to argue with a listener, but Steve Jobs, he referred it as OS 10," and
And he used the Roman numeral X.
And he used the Roman numeral X, and I guess what they're saying is, they're calling OS X now OS 10.
And what they're calling this new...
Well, the phone, the iPhone 10 X, right.
They called it X, and what was rumored in the leak last week was that stood for iPhone Exceptional.
Yeah.
It didn't. It stood for iPhone 10.
Well, I'm going to go through some of the things there, but one of the things I heard was the word wireless charging. Okay.
QI system.
Yeah, but the thing was, the impression that some of the articles you read about wireless charging is, "Oh, you mean that, I'm not tethered to anything." Well, they're not using any wires, but you have to make contact.
They implied that it was OTA, over the air.
Correct.
But it wasn't. What it was the key system has a little round pad, which incidentally, the first time I saw was at a Starbucks, where that little round pad was put into the countertop. It was actually inserted. And your phone has a connection that when it lays on that, it charges the battery. Now, is that something that Apple invented? No, absolutely not. It's called the key system, and for just a few dollars, you can buy a key receiver and use it in your existing Android phone and have that.
Well,
more important, though, is I think that the key system is not widely used any place, and Apple is betting an awful lot on their reputation.
Well, the other thing is that, in all fairness to Apple, they do not claim they invented any of this stuff, and yet
they implied.
Well, the journalists are giving them credit for it, and I don't know whether they got carried away or they just misunderstood Apple. Like one of the things that a journal said that, wow, they came up with something brand new called facial recognition.
And I immediately said,
I mean, we got cameras that were using facial recognition years ago.
But I have a Google Pixel phone which uses facial recognition. I got it last year.
And then the other thing that the some of these journalists are saying, wow, they came up with something new called edge-to-edge display. I guess they never heard of a Samsung, huh?
They never heard of the Samsung. What was it called? The not the Echo, but it was one of their versions.
Yeah, but the thing is, let me just put it this way. The big announcements that they basically made was that they came up with a couple of new phones. The big one is called the iPhone 10, and then they have a couple of Model 8 models, and the phones have a new screen technology called OLED, which is a higher resolution.
And incidentally, they did not invent OLED either.
Yeah, however, one of the things that I smile is because they also announced that the Apple TV set-top box now has 4K resolution capability, and I'm smiling because I said to Joe, there's no content on TV that's 4K.
What Hank is saying is that if you have a 4K TV set, doesn't mean you're going to be able to find anything. There's very, let me put it this way, there's very, very few shows that are broadcast in 4K.
You'd be hard-pressed to find it, okay?
I've never found one, but I've been told there are several.
And you know, most people don't realize that people talk about HDTV. You'll find that only half of the channels are HD to begin with. And by the way, you know why only half the channels are HD, the other are not? Very simple. It's because they can take the old channel, you know, with the old system, and if you divide it into four channels, you get HD. But you know what they do? They divide into eight channels, and you can't get HD on that.
Well, you know, I have RCN, Hank, and RCN uses the TiVo system for everything. And I was watching, or I wanted to watch the tennis last weekend, the Open. And I somehow picked up a station that was not an ESPN station, that was not HD. And up at the right...
Oh, yeah, 0.1, 0.2, 0.3.
Up at the right-hand corner, yeah. It said, for HD, press D on your TiVo.
Oh, okay.
So I looked down at the TiVo, and sure enough, there's an ABCD. I had never noticed it before. I pressed D, and it popped over to another station, which was the high def.
Yeah, well, what the channels are, what the cable companies are doing is that not everything is HD, and what they're doing is, and I know that a lot of the public, the education, and the government access channels, they're complaining, hey, where's our HD? You're supposed to treat us equally with commercial TV channels, and you're not. And the public channels are not getting HD.
Well, last year I noticed on a lot of stations, this year on almost none, where I'd be watching HDTV, and suddenly I would get a commercial that was not HDTV. And that made no sense to me. And then I realized later that the tapes that they sent out would produced years before that. They're just reusing them. And I don't know, Hank, it's more confusing.
Hey, you know what? Before I want to get to this something very quickly and just make it very short, okay? T-Mobile, there was a test run by an organization, and they use a program called Speed Test, and the organization is owned by Verizon, and they use Speed Test to test, and they reported that T-Mobile has the fastest and most consistent mobile data in the United States. That's honest reporting. In other words, Verizon is saying T-Mobile has the fastest.
No, Verizon isn't saying it. The wholly owned company, the subsidiary.
That's Verizon now. Come on. Is there any difference?
This has a different president. It might have even a new president
Well
tomorrow.
I was going to say, you know, is the guy still has his job? Oh, that's unbelievable. Hey, listen, we have it coming up in the last half hour, a couple of feature segments, and let me just touch on it. Dr. Alfred Paul will be covering a custom 3D printed insoles that was just released, and he's going to talk about energy harvesting, and he's talking about endoscopes that is for colonoscopy and endoscopy.
He's talking about external endoscopy. I don't understand that. You'll have to listen to the show to explain it.
And I contacted Marty Winston. I told him, listen, I got this stuff all over the house, and you know, wherever I find a counter space or a table space, hey, you know what? I put things there, and my wife would say to me, okay, but when are you removing this? I said, well, when it's reassembled. And some of the stuff I haven't reassembled in months because you just take it apart, and I'm waiting for parts. And, some of these parts, okay, they're not readily available because I have to get them overseas. Well, hey, that's a different story. And, by the way, just to remind everyone, last week's program, if you missed it, you can get it at prn.fm, and our website is pcradioshow.org. But let's now get to the feature segments.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Do your feet hurt? If they do, you're certainly not alone. But probably one of the main reasons why they may hurt is that your off-the-shelf shoes just don't fit you well enough. One of the common solutions to this problem is to get custom orthotics made up for you. Now, the way this normally happens is you go to an orthopedist and they take measurements of your feet and they send the measurements out to some sort of fabrication lab facility, and they create some orthotics, some shoe inserts for you, and send them back to you, and it can take days, weeks, and can be a very expensive process. There's a new system that's been developed by a company based in Phoenix working with a Chinese company, and their plan is to totally disrupt the custom footwear industry. What they've done is they've created a kiosk, and the way it works is you just walk up to the kiosk, you stand in a gel imaging platform in the kiosk. This surface will capture a 360-degree image of your foot. And then you type in some information about the types of shoes you wear and what kind of activities you go through, whether it's sports or running or things like that, and any relevant medical information. And then you go shopping for an hour. And when you come back, your custom inserts will be ready for you. The kiosk actually has a 3D printer inside, and it will 3D print the custom orthotics while you wait. So it's fast, it's easy, and presumably it's going to be very affordable and saves you a lot of time. So if your feet hurt, keep an eye out for these new kiosks that hopefully will be on the market before long. It's from a company called Resa Wearables, R-E-S-A Wearables. This could be a foot-changing development in the industry. If you're over the age of 50, you've probably already had an intimate introduction to a device called an endoscope. And this is a flexible catheter-type device that is inserted into your body cavities and allows physicians to perform a colonoscopy or an endoscopy and look inside your digestive tract, see if they can identify any disease or problems that need to be addressed. One of the interesting problems with this is they don't actually know precisely where the endoscope is located. At the tip of the endoscope, there's a camera and there's a light source. You would think that you could track it by tracking the light source, but the problem is, just as when you shine a flashlight through your hand, the light gets diffused and you can't tell exactly where the source of light is. So if you try to track the weak light that is emitted through the patient's body during this process, again, the light gets diffused and it's hard to know exactly where the device is located. Obviously, you could use some other kinds of medical imaging, x-rays or something like that, but that's not really a practical solution. Researchers at the University of Edinburgh College of Medicine and Veterinary Medicine have come up with a way that might work even better. They use what's called a photon camera. What a photon camera does is it only accepts light that travels in a straight line. So it can identify individual photons. A conventional camera absorbs all the reflected light that's bouncing around and coming from all different angles. With this photon camera, they're able to see with pinpoint precision the light source at the end of the endoscope. And so this could help provide more precision about the location of areas of concern when doing a colonoscopy. But it also points the way in the future to other minimally invasive procedures. If you could put a light source at the end of the tools that you're using, it could provide surgeons with the much more accurate location information about where they're performing their procedure in the body. I've spoken about all kinds of interesting energy harvesting technologies here in other sessions. Then I'm back again with a new one. This one is quite interesting and it's quite different. Researchers at the University of Texas at Dallas and at Hanyang University in South Korea have worked together to create what they call twistron yarns. Basically, these yarns are made up of carbon nanotube fibers. Carbon nanotubes are the tubes made out of a single atom layer of carbon atoms. These tubes are 10,000 times smaller than a human hair and are extremely lightweight, but are also extremely strong. They're one of the strongest materials in terms of strength versus weight that is available at this point. So what they've done is they found that they can twist the yarn so much that it starts to coil up on itself, much like when you wind up a rubber band in a rubber band-powered airplane. What they've discovered is that when it's coiled like that, when they pull on the yarn to stretch it or bend it, the yarn produces electricity, and this can be captured. So it converts that motion energy into electricity. The amazing thing about this technology is it actually produces quite a lot of power for a given weight of material. They were able to create 250 watts per kilogram when it was stretched at 30 times per second. The other interesting thing about this compared to other energy harvesting materials is that it's effective at low frequency motions, as low as a few cycles per second, all the way up to higher frequency motions up to 600 cycles per second. So it can be very versatile for harvesting all kinds of energy, from garments to harvesting energy from motion in cars and other vehicles. There's all kinds of things that it could be done. For example, they've sewn the yarn into a shirt, and they were able to generate an electrical signal that could be used to power a sensor in its controller. According to one of the researchers, it produced over 100 times more electrical power per weight when stretched compared with other weavable fibers that have been recorded in the literature. And they also found that just 31 milligrams of their yarn could generate enough electricity to transmit a 2 kilobyte packet of data over 100 meter radius every 10 seconds. So 100 meters, that's like a football field length. So this could be a significant source of power for self-powered sensors and other devices, so that that just by harvesting energy that would be otherwise lost. They've even experimented using this material to convert wave action in the ocean into electricity. So it looks like it's highly efficient, highly scalable. If they can produce it at low enough cost, it could be practical for all kinds of large-scale kinds of applications. And for applications that don't require much power, such as many wearable health tech kinds of applications, it could produce enough electricity to be affordable as it stands now. So this could be an exciting new way to power the devices that are going to be parts of our lives going forward. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. My work projects tend to creep onto any available work surface. Unlike a typical workplace where a lab of sort is available to set up for testing, there is always some equipment in an unassembled state. To make peace at home, I've asked Marty Winston what he might suggest as an electronic workbench, that, if possible, the workbench should be invisible, and it should, well, it should look like as if it was part of the furniture in the house, so it wouldn't be noticed. I guess that's asking for too much, and it's probably impossible, but Marty, what's in your bag of magic dust?
One thing you might guess about our 40-year cybernetic house is that it doesn't build itself, certainly not the electronics part. I have a test bench here I've been meaning to tell you about for a while. I'm going to spell a word. It's kind of important because it's the company that comes up with this. It's Joburg's, S-J-O-B-E-R-G-S, Swedish, Joburg's. S-J-O-B-E-R-G-S, and I got this in for review, and I've been adapting it, a Joburg's Scandi Plus 1825 model workbench with their SM03 optional storage cabinets. I'll explain all that in a second, but I want you to know this is not intended as an electronics bench. I'm making it one. It is made for a woodworking bench. In fact, it's made for a cabinet maker. The bench itself is gorgeous. It looks like furniture. It's this wonderful knot-free European beech, and it's a strong. It's just pretty. It's just pretty. And what we've done. Oh, I should give you a sense of dimension. The bench is more or less 3 feet high, just a fraction of an inch less than 3 feet high, more or less 2 feet deep, just about 6 feet wide. On the left up front, it's got a vise, not the kind you're used to, but one for woodworking, so it's wider. It opens up to 4.5 inches, and we have another one of those over on the right side. So clamping things, which you've got to do more than you think about in electronics, got really easy. So here's this gorgeous, huge benchtop. Underneath, there's the SM03, that's the accessory part number, which is a combination storage area with three drawers two shallow ones at the top, deeper one at the bottom, and a two-door cabinet. So under the bench, it's almost like having cupboards. This is terrific. This is one of the best workbenches I've ever had a chance to work with. Now, what do I do with this thing to make it an electronics bench? And what do I mean by that? Okay, there are two things I need to worry about. One is analysis. So on the left of the bench, and I should add, ALLSOP, A-L-L-S-O-P, makes these two different kinds of adjustable monitor stands. And by adjustable, I mean height adjustable. I was able to get these two kinds, one of each. It didn't matter which end got which, but one of each, and get them set up for just a little over 7 inches below the shelf. That's a lot of clearance, but what it does is in the corners of this bench, I have two double-decker areas to hold important things. On the left, toward the rear, a signal generator, a bench power supply, an oscilloscope. We'll have a separate segment on oscilloscopes, meters, and that kind of thing. On the right, a Weller soldering station, you know, the kind with the knob on it, control the temperature, just all self-contained, including the holder. Got some desoldering tools. I've got a pan of ice, some assorted heat sinks and aids and that kind of thing. An LED light, because you need to see this stuff. You know, some of those aids have the little clips to hold things and magnifying glass. And there's a lovely silicone soldering mat that is not only going to heat protect the bench, it also has areas for little tiny hardware or components so you don't lose them. And that gets very important in the surface mount age. Yes, this rig can help me do surface mount soldering. I should mention it and the test gear are plugged into something in a tray that's underneath the benchtop. I'll try to describe that. The basic legs and frame of this are what they call a trestle. It's the uprights, it's the frame, it's the structural rigidity of this, and this is also beechwood. The pieces came separately. We're talking in the order of 200 pounds that came in and took one of our garage spaces for a while. I had to open the cardboard up and take the pieces to our work area in the bonus room up above the garage, almost one at a time. But when I say one at a time, the benchtop was a unit, one whole piece. It was heavy. I didn't know if I'd ever make it up the stairs. Got it here. Mounting it back on the trestle was a different thing. But what I wanted to mention is between the benchtop and the trestle is a tray area. And that tray area is above the top of the cabinets, which are, by the way, another separate unit that had to get hauled up those lovely steps. So, okay, if you've got a picture of that, we've got the test gear on one side, the soldering gear on the other, big work area in the front and also back center. And underneath a tray, and at the rear of it in the tray, is a long power strip that's plugged into a surge protector. Now, why? A couple of reasons. One is I don't want surges online ruining my stuff. And the other is when I'm using power tools that happen to plug in, I don't want the power tools to be sending surges to the computers and everything else that are here. So power strip under there on the tray, completely movable, but fits very nicely, plugged into a surge protector, so I've got surge protection. I mentioned the drawers and the cabinet area behind the doors. There are three drawers, bigger and deeper from the top down. The top one holds tools, specifically my basic electronic tools. We're talking wire cutters and pliers and screwdrivers and that kind of thing, and including things small enough that if I need to, I can open up smartphones with them. The second drawer has the parts that go into whatever project I'm working on at the moment. And the third drawer, the bottom drawer, holds additional test gear that I may not be using as part of what's on the bench at the moment. For example, I have light meters and sound meters, remote read thermometers, and that kind of thing. The cabinet has a bag in it, a kit bag with network testers and cabling tools for wiring up Ethernet connections. It also has a homebrew AC test rig for when I have to test 120-volt stuff, you know, switches and things that go in sockets and things that mount in electrical boards and that kind of thing. I'm experienced enough not to fry myself. I'm still very cautious. I don't recommend an AC rig until you're ready for that kind of work. I also have a number of other things down there, some lint-free paper towels, some microfiber towels, a fire extinguisher, some sprays, package of Band-Aids, you never know, and, oh yes, a lighted magnifier headband. Working with small stuff, there's never enough light, there's never enough magnification. One other thing I keep there that's kind of important, Murphy's Oil Soap Spray Clean and Shine. This is furniture-grade beechwood. I'm not going to let it go to pot. Now, one thing I want you to know, and the reason I've asked Hank to put this episode in now, I want to say this gently. When I first got this bench, I looked, Amazon has it for, something over $3,000. Schoberg's told me they've got a special on it. I looked it up. It's less than half that. So I just want you to know in case this interests you. But really, it's about the bench. So let's talk just for a few seconds about what's happening here. When I bring gear onto the bench to figure out how it works, that's the left side. That's where I'm working with the oscilloscope, the voltmeters, signal tracers, whatever I need, the signal generators in some cases to excite it separately or to follow an analog or digital path through. That's where I figure that stuff out. And I have to tell you that the oscilloscope is new. I had one decades ago. This one is new. And, oh, brother, marvelous. It's just terrific. On the other side, the soldering got upgraded 4 times in the last 4 months. This Weller kit is absolutely meow what you want. The Panavice is a huge help, and that little LED light makes a lot of work possible. So what I'm doing is figuring out how things work, why they don't, what I can do to make them work better, and what fits in our house. Now, when I get done with everything, I try to make notes. And when I take the notes to the computer, what do? What Hank always says. I back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. It sounds like the workbench will enable me to centralize my work tools and projects into one location. I just have to figure out how I'm going to sneak it into the house without notice.
Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the Northeast Tri-State area. The New York Amateur Computer Club will be having a meeting on Rules of Thumb for Computer Security Thursday, September the 14th, 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 401, at 31 Washington Place in Manhattan, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on AT&T Digital Life Home Automation, Friday, September the 15th at 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartow Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Princeton PC Users Group will have their meeting Tuesday, September the 26th at 7 p.m. at Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on Teaching People How to Use Modern Computing Devices, Thursday, September the 28th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m. They'll be meeting at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will meet Tuesday, October the 3rd, meeting time is 7:30 p.m., Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will meet Friday, October the 13th, 7 p.m., at the New York Institute of Technology at the Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they'll be meeting in the Anna Rubin Hall or the 300 building. These meetings are open to the public and free of charge to attend, and we hope to see you there. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org. And we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and also on WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. And back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe, keep cool, and until we meet again,
Same time, same station next week.